Okay, Ezra chapter 1. Let me ask you a question, however, before we begin. Have you ever read from the Bible and started in Genesis and just started reading your way through and wondered in your mind, is this the chronology in which these events happened? And you read about something and then later you're reading about the same thing. And you're not sure exactly if it's happening again or if there is a reference made to some details or if this is a restatement of the same thing or if it fits in this order of chronology. Have you ever done that? Well, I want to talk with you about that in our study this morning. We have identified in previous studies that the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy, to some degree, Deuteronomy being a restatement of the law, a lot of material in those that are essentially the same. And then when you come into 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, we've already studied that and we've learned that it's like reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John about the life of Christ. You get some details here, some details there, but it's kind of a synoptic story of the period of the kings. Well, when we study where we are now, as you have been studying regarding the Persian Empire, I think, the last two Bible classes, we want to study now concerning the return of the Israelites to the land. And books like Ezra and Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah and Malachi fit in that time period. Now, I know there are a lot of other books that are in the Old Testament. We've referred to some of those in reference to the period of the captivity. We've just studied about Daniel and Ezekiel and noted that these were two who were among the captives. During that time frame, we talked about Amos and Hosea and some of those Old Testament books that often we're not as familiar with as we are some others. But if you would like to be prepared for the class each time you come, be sure that you have a good familiarity with Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, and Zechariah, and Malachi, because these all deal with that period of restoration, period of Old Testament history. Okay? Any questions or comments just here? I want you to note that Ezra and Nehemiah are primarily, all of these the same time frame, but Ezra, the return of the people, he's bringing them back. When we read about the book of Haggai, we read about the rebuilding of the temple. And when we read about the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah is rebuilding the walls around the temple. The book of Esther is really a fascinating story of the providence of God, as Esther eventually becomes the queen of Persia. And we note in that there was one who decided that he was going to kill all the Jews. Now, this particular time frame is significant. If you've got all the Jews throughout the kingdom of Persia all killed, what's going to happen to the promise God made to Abraham? In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. How would that occur? You see, if all the Jews were killed, that wouldn't happen. Now, Esther was a Jew, and the king didn't know she was a Jew. But she became his wife. And when the plot was made to kill all the Jews, Esther was going to die one way or the other. She was going to die, number one, because she was a Jew. But if she approached the king on behalf of the Jews, without him having sent for her, he had the authority to kill her. So Esther's story is quite a fascinating story. I would urge you to read that. It deals with the providence of God, and we see how that God used Esther to preserve those people alive so that the promise might come to pass. Zechariah contains a great deal of messianic prophecy as it speaks concerning things that would occur in that day. And we'll talk about that perhaps at a later time. Malachi, Don and I were talking about that yesterday. Malachi is a fascinating book because as he writes toward the end of this restoration period. And what has happened is that the zeal and the enthusiasm that had characterized the people when they returned and rebuilt, eventually rebuilt the temple and rebuilt the walls around the city, now they've got all these things in place, but they had become so indifferent and apathetic toward their worship to God that Malachi rebukes them. And severely, and we want to see that as our studies develop. So these books, these six books, are books I want you to be very familiar with. None of them are really all that long, but they'll be helpful to you if you read over them and be familiar with their content, and especially understand that they all are bookend by this restoration period of Old Testament history. Any questions or comments? My thing doesn't work. Let's try it again. Nope. Still doesn't work. There we go. Okay. So what I want to do now is to begin with the first chapter of Ezra. The first chapter of Ezra. And note that Jerusalem begins to be re-inhabited and rebuilt. Now, as you look at the first chapter of Ezra, beginning in verse 1 and 2, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all the kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah." Now, we know that Jeremiah had prophesied a great deal about the fall of Judah, the captivity of Babylon, and even the fall of Babylon. The last few chapters of the book of Jeremiah, very dramatic description of the fall of Babylon. But it's Isaiah that names Cyrus as the king who would write a decree and allow the people to return. So I'd like for you to tell me, when we want to familiarize ourselves with the prophecy of Isaiah, where would we turn? We've looked at it before, but I want you to remember where it is. Where is it that Isaiah named the man? Now keep in mind that Isaiah was writing during the period of the captivity, or just prior, of the northern kingdom. Yes, Isaiah 44 and 45. Isaiah 44 and 45. Hold your finger here at the first chapter of Ezra and turn in your Bible to Isaiah chapter 44. Isaiah chapter 44. In chapter 44, beginning in verse 27, verse 27, Isaiah said, "That saith to the deep, Be dry, and I will dry up the rivers. He saith of Cyrus, He is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, She shall be built, and of the temple, Thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Jehovah to His anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut." What is it that Isaiah said that Cyrus would do? He's going to rebuild Jerusalem. That's right. And the temple. Now, the irony is, this was about 200 years before Cyrus was ever born, and certainly before the Medo-Persian Empire had been established. And Isaiah names the name of the man and tells us what is going to take place. Now, you'll notice a similar thought in the last paragraph of 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles leaves off with this decree of Cyrus after this 70-year period of captivity. And that's how Ezra began. Cyrus said, I'm going to rebuild the temple. Now, God has charged me to do that. Now, that sets the stage for the book of Ezra so that we know what it is about. Now, the northern 10 tribes have been scattered by the Assyrian Empire. You remember this map? And we talked about little old Judah right here, how that during the reign of King Hezekiah, they were faithful. What was it that the Assyrian Empire did with those that they took captive? Scattered them out. Scattered them out all among the nations that they had taken captive. Well, we want to note, this is where the Jews are located. But the southern kingdom, when Judah over here is taken captive, the Babylonians, what do they do with them? They leave some of them, but they take some of them. And what I want us to see is that now, whether they're left or whether they're taken, the Babylonian Empire has control of all of the nation of Israel, both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Now, when Cyrus makes this decree during his reign, look at what he owns. He owns the people of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And wherever they've been dispersed by the Assyrians, he writes a decree. And in verse 3, look at the text, Ezra chapter 1, whosoever there be, or whosoever there is among you of all his people, his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And whosoever is left in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver and with gold and with goods and with beasts, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Now, what does Cyrus declare? Notice the first word of that passage. Whosoever. Whosoever. The thing I want us to see is that Cyrus is saying, it doesn't matter where you live throughout the kingdom, where the Assyrians may have dispersed you, where the Babylonians have taken you, doesn't make any difference. Where you are throughout the kingdom, you can go back and rebuild in Jerusalem. Now, suppose you don't want to go back. What can you do? Many did not go back. And you can see why. Because since the beginning of this period of captivity, since Samaria has been destroyed in the northern kingdom, it's been about 200 years. Now, if you're displaced and your family's displaced and now you've been established in a place for this length of time, it may be that you just don't want to be uprooted. You'll just stay put. And some of them did. And you'll notice in the text, Cyrus says, whosoever is left, verse 4, wheresoever he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver and so forth. The idea is if you stay here and you don't go back to Jerusalem, you can help those who do. You can give them silver and gold and so forth in order that they might go back and rebuild. Not that I know of. It just says that Cyrus said, he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem. So evidently God had, through some means, communicated to him to rebuild the temple in the city of Jerusalem. The irony of that, I think, is specifically so, here's the man that Isaiah named. And now he's saying this. You can look at that and say, providence. I don't know if there was any political advantage to him or not. Now, one of the things we will note that Cyrus did, he appointed certain men over what we might refer to as states and then counties and so forth. So it was kind of a pyramid relationship to him, the king, which proved quite expeditious to provide the needs of the kingdom. Well, that large, that's right. There had to be some significant organization to it, and that's right. Interesting text here in the New Testament. We read about a particular Jews that were of the tribe of Asher, I believe. Check that for me. I believe it was from the tribe of Asher. The point being, here were some that were dispersed in other places that were from these other tribes, indicating that they desired not to return. Now, I want to make this, I almost passed it up. The most recent captives had been gone 50 years. Now, you remember that Jeremiah had said this 70-year period. And we count that 70 years from the beginning of the first captives, about 606 B.C. And then their release, 536 B.C. But that doesn't mean that all the captives have been in Babylon for 70 years. From the beginning of that captivity to its end was 70 years. Some of them had been there about 50 years. But they desired to stay. They're happy where they are and had no desire to return. But as we continue in the book of Ezra, turn the page, if you will, to chapter 2. Chapter 1 gives a laundry list of those who returned from this period of captivity. But in chapter 2, chapter 2 gives that laundry list. In chapter 2, beginning in verse 64, I need a reader. David, would you mind to read for me? Verses 64 through 67, please. Ezra chapter 2. Ezra chapter 2. Verses 64 through 67. All right, when you look at the people, we're not counting the animals just here, but when you look at the people, we're looking at approximately 50,000 of these people who gathered in Babylon to start the journey home. They're going home. Now, Cyrus gives them provisions. Their brethren who want to remain where they are provide for them. And they leave with a great deal of wealth going back to rebuild in Jerusalem. In Ezra chapter 1 and these other passages that I have, Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel, they're simply named as leaders who would lead these people back into the land. Some believe, and frankly I don't know, but some believe that these two names are the same man. I don't know. But at any rate, these are those who led them back. We read the name Zerubbabel a lot more than Sheshbazzar. But we'll talk about some of those things a bit later on. But we want to observe that when Cyrus writes this decree to let the people go home, and he supplies for them riches and so forth that they can rebuild, that we know that there were no gods to give back to them so they could go back and rebuild. Why? That's not the one you were looking for. Okay. All I know is what verse 3, or 2 and 3 of chapter 1 tells us. I'm sorry, I'm thinking, processing your question. Your question had to do with others that were taken captive, whether or not they were allowed to go back. I don't have any evidence of that. Yeah. 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 I would call that in question whether he did or not, but I don't know. John, and then Juan, please. Well, that's right. This has to do with the people's relationship to God and, of course, the fulfillment of the scheme of redemption. One other observation in that passage that you were reading is in verse 3. His God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel. He is God. Juan and then Jenny. All the captives.
Go back to their homeland,
yeah.
And build their places of worship. And so it's not unheard of that,
yeah,
the Jews recording it would only focus on the part where the Jews get killed.
Yeah. Yeah. The evidence you're citing is not necessarily biblical evidence, but world history. Right? Okay. Okay. I'd be interested in reading some of that. If you can bring that to my attention, I'd like that. I wanted to see if there, my reason is to see if there's any comparison in the text that might provide us some evidence of that. Okay? Now, back to my question. No gods to return to the Jews. Why? All right. But when they had been taken captive by the Assyrians, they were worshiping all kinds of gods in Israel. And when the Babylonians took them captive and destroyed the city of Jerusalem, they were worshiping all kinds of gods. And perhaps you remember when the people were brought into the land of Palestine by the Assyrian king, as he's mixing them up, they were complaining that we don't know the gods of this land, and therefore the lions are eating us, so he brought back a priest, and the priest was supposed to instruct the people about the God of the land. And what was the result of all of that? Just another God. And so they worshiped Jehovah right along with their idols. And so that was the gist of that. And of course, you recall when the Assyrian king came to Hezekiah, he said, the gods of all these other folks, they haven't been able to save them. What makes you think your God can save you? And so the equating of idols with the worship of Jehovah was commonplace. But now, what have the children of Israel learned in captivity? Yes. And there's only one. Only one God. Only one God. None of the others could save them. No. Yeah. And so it was. Everything happened just exactly like God said. So we've got these people that are returning to the promised land, as it were. And you'll note in verse 68 of chapter 2, Ezra chapter 2, and some of the heads of the fathers' houses, when they came to the house of Jehovah, which is in Jerusalem, the God, house of God, to set it up in its place, they gave after their ability into the treasury of the work 71,000 derricks of gold and 5,000 pounds of silver, 100 priest garments. Now here are things that are provided for them in order that they might return to the city of Jerusalem and do that which Cyrus has commissioned them to do. In the third chapter, we read of their going into the city and their efforts then to rebuild. And we might look at the third chapter and say that this is really a great chapter and a day to worship and glorify the God of heaven, and rightly so. They're going home. Yes, John? All right.
Yeah.
Actually, I could say both. We're going to see in the book of Nehemiah that Cyrus had given instruction. We'll see it just a little bit later here in Ezra. But Cyrus had given instruction not only to those who want to stay in the land to help those who return. Cyrus had contributed so that people could return. And Cyrus had written letters to the governors throughout the provinces that whatever was asked for was to be given. And that's fascinating, especially when you come to the book of Nehemiah and he's rebuilding the walls. He needs supplies. He needs money and all these kind of things. And instructions are given by Cyrus the king to provide whatever he needs. Interesting. I said Cyrus. By then, we're talking about the king Artaxerxes. But the idea is the same. The king commissioned that whatever they needed be provided. Okay? Good question. Anything else? All right, now going back into the city and rebuilding the walls and rebuilding the temple and so forth, that's not going to be a real easy task, is it? Especially when you think of what's happened during this period of time of captivity. Now, again, I want us to expand our thinking just a bit beyond this 70 years that Jeremiah had mentioned. The 70-year period of captivity was the Babylonian captivity, and that was from the beginning of the captives of Judah to the ending of that captivity. But if you back that thing up to the time when the Assyrian captivity began, we're looking at about 721, 722 B.C., depending upon what source you might cite, and that was about how long? Mathematicians in the family? From about 722 to 586. Almost 150 years. We're looking at a long period of time. What's happened during that time? Well, we've talked about the Samaritans. Who were the Samaritans? John, tell me about the Samaritans. How did they develop? All right. All right, we read about them in 2 Kings chapter 17. If you're making notes, and I'd encourage you to do that, write that down. 2 Kings chapter 17. The Samaritans then became this mixed people that were in the northern kingdom. Well, what did they do? 150, 200 years. What do? All right, the Israelites have been taken out. So what you do is you settle in. You begin to expand. And the Samaritans did that. And then the Ammonites. The Ammonites, as we began our study of this period of Old Testament history, we noted that they're off to what would be the east and the south. The Ammonites' territory was not the most desirable, but they looked up here to the plains of Gilead, and it's well-watered. It's a good place for the raising of livestock. And when the people then are taken captive, what do the Ammonites do? Well, there's nobody there, you see. For the most part, we just move in. And that's what they did. And then we've talked about the Edomites that descended from Esau. Thank you. I didn't even have said that. That didn't sound right. Esau. They descended from Esau. And they're down here in the portion just south of the Dead Sea. Now, we've studied about that, and we've known that from the Dead Sea coming south, you're rising in elevation. But that area is very arid, very desert, very undesirable. And then what do the Edomites do? They look up here to Judah. Well, those in Judah, for the most part, they've been taken captive by the Babylonians. Here it is. What do the Edomites do? They just move in. And then the nomadic tribes over in what we would think of as the Arabian Desert, they look over here and there's country that's desirable to them. So they begin to establish themselves in the land from which the Israelites have come. Now, that in itself would present a problem. Let's look, if you will, on this map over here, first of all, because it illustrates what the Assyrian Empire did. Here's the beginning of the Samaritans right here. And I don't know how to do that. Maybe, Juan, you can show me someday. But to make that circle just expand. That's what the Samaritans did. And when we come over here, you see where the Ammonites are. And here's the land of Gilead up in here, where cattle were so easy to raise and sheep. And so the Ammonites just moved on up into this area. And when you look at the Edomites here just south of the Dead Sea, what did they do? They moved right on up in here in the area of Judah and took that over. And here's the Arabian Desert over here, and you can just point a line heading toward the sea. That's what they did. They went where they wanted to. So if where you lived wasn't very desirable, here is this conquered territory. And so you slowly but surely expand your claim into that conquered territory. And that's what they did. And they grew, and they grew, and they grew. Now, if you were among the Israelites returning to that land, you might expect it to be just like it was. But with the passing of time, it's not like it was. There are people there, and things have changed. Now, I think in your lesson book, we know that there were three returns that are described in Ezra and Nehemiah. And we want to be familiar with these as they go out of the kingdom of Persia under the release of Cyrus and go back into the land. Number one, we know that the Jews returned home under the leadership of Zerubbabel to build the temple. And we see the starting of that in Ezra chapter 3 through chapter 6. And of course, the book of Haggai is specifically about the building of the temple. Okay? The second one that we want to be familiar with is that Ezra returns with the priest to start the spiritual reforms that are necessary. And you see why. You have to establish the priesthood. And we'll study in the book of Nehemiah how that was done according to the books of the genealogy. Now, why was that so important? Who only could be priests? The Levites. That's right. So when Ezra returns with the priest to start this during the days of Nehemiah, the priesthood then was established as far as the genealogies were concerned. Thirdly, the book of Nehemiah specifically is dealing with the rebuilding of the walls around the city of Jerusalem. And we'll enjoy talking about all of those. I get a little excited about this particular period of time because of their efforts to rise and build, as we use that expression. But as we talk about this first wave of return, the Jews returned to Palestine under Zerubbabel. Now, again, as we looked at chapter 3, we'd say, boy, what a grand occasion to be released. We get to go home. Everything's wonderful. Well, at first you might think that. And as you begin reading about verse 8 of chapter 3, it says, now in the second year of their coming into the house of God at Jerusalem, or unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and the rest of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to have the oversight of the work of the house of Jehovah. Then stood Jeshua with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel, and his sons of Judah, the sons of Judah, together to have the oversight of the workmen in the house of God. The sons of Henadad, with the sons, their sons and their brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of God, they set the priest in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise Jehovah after the order of David, king of Israel. And they sang one to another in praising and giving thanks unto Jehovah, saying, for he is good, for his loving kindness endureth forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised Jehovah, because the foundation of the house of Jehovah was laid. Now that sounds like a big to-do, doesn't it? Yeah, and it was. for a while. But verse 12 says, but many of the priests and the Levites and heads of the fathers' houses, the old men that had seen the first house when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern from the noise of the shout of joy, from the noise of the weeping of the people, for the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. Now that's really sad, is it not? We've got those who are appointed 20 years old and older to serve as priests. How long has this captivity been going on? 70 years. All right, 150 plus years as we look at the beginning of the Assyrian captivity forward. Now, some of these folks, during this 70-year period of captivity, they were over here in Jerusalem and were taken over there by the Babylonians. And they remember what the temple was like. These young folks don't remember that. But those old folks do. And what do the old folks do when they see what the young folks have started building? They cry. Why? Not the same. No. What we had way back when, boy, it's a whole lot nicer than this. Very disappointing. But you've got to take those small steps in order to get to where you want to be. And, of course, Zechariah and Nehemiah also talk about those old men and what they saw. I said Nehemiah, Haggai chapter 2, verse 3. They just couldn't see how it could ever be. But you've got to start. Now, they rebuilt the altar, burnt offering, and began their regular sacrifices, and it was a day to celebrate. Because now we're starting. We've laid the foundation. Now, we mentioned that there were other people in the land. And with other people in the land, what would you have reason to expect? They don't want to give it up. No. And they certainly don't want to see you succeed. So now we have adversaries that began to do everything in their power to stop the work. Turn, if you will, over, first of all, to the text of Nehemiah. We'll begin there in Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2. Now, remember that Nehemiah was cupbearer to King Artaxerxes in chapter 1. And King Artaxerxes has commissioned Nehemiah to go back and lead the people in the rebuilding of the walls. Now, Nehemiah's arrival is really after the rebuilding of the temple. But Nehemiah is still finding opposition. In Nehemiah chapter 2, reading beginning in verse 9, it says, then I come to the governors beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. John, here's the point we were talking about a moment ago. Now the king had sent with me captains of the army and horsemen, and when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly, for that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Well, now think about that. Here's somebody that's come to benefit these people who are among the remnant that has been returned to the land. And those who are living in the land, they don't like that. Because these men come with commissioned letters, authority, to do what God has told them to do. So what do you think is necessary? If you're going to stop the building, we'll talk more about what these men did, but you've got to undermine the authority with which they build. And that's what takes us back to Ezra chapter 4. Going back to Ezra chapter 4, verse 1, it says, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity were building a temple unto Jehovah, the God of Israel, then they drew near to Zerubbabel and to the heads of fathers' houses and said unto them, let us build with you, for we seek your God. as ye do, and sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Judah, king of Assyria, who brought us up hither. I want to pause right there. These folks that we're reading about that want to help with the rebuilding of the temple, who are they? Yeah, but the Samaritans in particular. They don't want Judah and Benjamin to succeed in this. And question, when the Samaritans had said, as we see here, we worship the same God that you do, what did they know about God? Nothing. And what then was the response of the Israelites to the Samaritans' desire to come and let us build with you? Thanks, but no thanks. Does that create a problem? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, beginning at verse 3, it says, "But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said unto them, ye have nothing to do with us in building a house unto our God. But we ourselves together will build unto Jehovah, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah, and troubling them in building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia, and in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem." Now let's just abbreviate some things here to get us a little farther down the track. When these hire counselors to accuse the Jews, they want to accuse the Jews of being a very rebellious people and send this now to the king down the pike, you see, Artaxerxes. And they sent a copy, verse 11, to King Artaxerxes. And they say, you know, these people, all they ever do is cause trouble. And you don't want to turn them loose to rebuild their temple. Now, that's a very loose mix of paraphrase of the text. But that's the essence of what he's telling them in this letter, or telling the king in this letter. He says in verse 11, "Thy servants, the men beyond the river, and so forth, be it known unto the king that the Jews that come up from thee are come to us unto Jerusalem. They are building the rebellious and the bad city, and have furnished the walls and repaired the foundations. Be it known now unto the king that if this city be builded and the walls finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and in the end it will be hurtful to the king." You see their reasoning? That's pretty simple. You won't collect taxes off of them if you let them finish this. They're bad folks, you see. In this city, it's a bad city. And so we don't want them to rebuild. In verse 14, "Now because we eat the salt of the palace, and it is not meet for us to see the king's dishonor, therefore have we sent and certified the king." Now, talk about dishonorable motives. See, we're the good folks, and they're the bad folks, and because we seek to be faithful to you, it's why we told you about these bad folks. David? Exactly. Well, that's right. She thought we worship God. And Jesus made an interesting comment to her. I believe it's in John 4, verse 21. He said, "Ye worship that which ye know not. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews." Well, when we look historically to the beginning of the Samaritans, the 2 Kings 17, they'd never really known God, had they? Not accurately. So this Samaritan woman saying, "We worship God," it was lacking. Woefully lacking. Looking back at the text of Ezra chapter 4, these who are critics of the children of Israel rebuilding in Jerusalem, they say, "Search the records. Just search the records, and you'll see that these people are bad folks. They've always been causing trouble throughout their history. Just go back and look at the records. Now, if you would go back and look at the records, what would you find? If you looked at the Babylonian records, what would you find? Well, before that. Yeah. They've been going down to Egypt to buy off mercenaries to help prevent their captivity by the Babylonians. So if you look back in the records, you would find that this accusation really was, in some respects, true, wasn't it? And when you look at the northern kingdom, if you had the availability of the Assyrian records, what was it that Shalmaneser commanded of Hezekiah and he wouldn't do? What became typical? If you're... Yeah, they'll help for a little bit and then they quit and so forth. So when you look back in the records of the Assyrians, you look back in the records of the Babylonians, you'll find that these accusations, to some degree, they're true. These are terrible people. They won't be faithful to you. They'll rebel against you. They won't pay taxes. They'll do all these bad things. If you let them build the temple, and you see the point. Well, the king does look through the records, and what does he find? He finds the truth of what has been said, or at least partial truth of what has been said. So what does he do? Look at verse 21 of chapter 4. The insistence of the opposition to the king, they said, make now a decree to cause these men to cease and that this city be not builded until the decree shall be made by me. And take heed that ye be not slack therein. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the kings? What is it that the king is compelled to do? Stop the building. Yeah, we've got to stop this building. So all are instructed, whatever you have to do, you stop the building. In fact, if you'll notice in verse 23, make them to cease by force. So you see the point. We've got to stop the building of the temple and stop the building of the city of Jerusalem. It says in verse 24, then cease the work of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and it ceased in the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And we'll stop there. But I want to pick up there next time simply because that begins a whole new chapter in their history. Okay? You might pick up the reading there and couple with it the reading of the book of Haggai.